Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Bhagavad Gita study group. Since this is class, we'll do a little bit differently than normal service, and I'll just move right into the materials. So one of each of the introduction. Getting handed two pieces of paper here, one with bullet points, and that's the one that we'll go over first. It says introduction. And I'll start out with a little introduction that's not on the bullet points. I have read and loved the Gita the past 35 years or so, and studied it. I don't read Sanskrit, which is the original language that it was printed in, or composed in, rather. They didn't have printing then. Everything was memorized. And the Bhagavad Gita is a small part of a much larger epic poem, the Mahabharata. Mahabharata and the Ramayana are two epic poems, and they're much, much bigger than the Iliad or the Odyssey, and predate them by quite a bit. There's some controversy over how old they are. There's estimates anywhere from 500 BC to 6000 BC. The most general date that's given usually is around 3000 BC. One of the things that I love about the Bhagavad Gita is it's a spiritual guide for people who are living in the world but don't want to be of it, as Jesus referred to. So it's a very much a hands-on kind of guide. It's a discussion between Krishna and Arjuna. And Krishna is considered an avatar. An avatar in India means descent of divinity into flesh. He's not somebody who was born as a human being and then had to go through the steps of realization until he came into a state of that kind of realization. Rather, he's born into the world with it. He's a friend of Arjuna's. He's a king, as Arjuna is also a king and a ruler of the area. They're both of the Kshatriya caste, and the Kshatriya castes are the warriors and the rulers. They were born into the Pandu family, and the Pandu family, Pandu means white or light colored, and they're basically considered the good guys in the story, and the Kurus are the bad guys. They're the cousins of each other, but the Pandus have their father and their mother, and they go out, and the father dies when the Pandus are still an early age. They are brought in by the Kurus and raised as cousins, as family, but they're always in conflict with their cousins, and there's 100 of the cousins, and there's 5 of the Pandus. So these are always tussling. In fact, there's times when the Kurus, Duryodhana is the oldest cousin, and he's really got it in for the Pandus. They try to burn down the house that they're sleeping in at one point. They try to poison them. They don't play by the rules. They are always jealous of what the Pandus are doing. And as adults, they continue in that kind of a conflict. One time there's a dice game, and Yudhishthira, who's the oldest of the Pandus, he likes to gamble. And so they're throwing these dice, and Duryodhana has his uncle throw the dice for him. His uncle is shrewd and probably not ethical. He cheats. And he takes everything away from the Pandus, including their wife. Everything's taken away, their lands, everything. And what they give them is 13 years they have to remain away, actually in hiding. And if they're discovered during that time, they can be killed. When they return after 13 years, they're supposed to get everything back. That was the conditions of the dice game, or what happened just after the dice game. So they go off, and for 12 years, they go from village to village, and they are like wandering mendicants. And then one day, they enter into their 13th year, and they go up onto a hilltop, and they're there. There are several times where the Kurus try to come after them and kill them, but they're unsuccessful. So the Pandus come back, and they say, all right, we're back, and we want our lands that was promised to us. Duryodhana says, no way. Not giving you anything. He'd rather kill them. He'd rather have them off the face of the earth. So what to do? And they have both gained allies, and they're lining up their allies, and it looks like it may lead to a war. Krishna is asked to intercede, and he comes, and he meets with the Pandus and the Kurus, and Duryodhana in particular, and he acts as mediator. And he's also related. He's within the royal family. So he's known to them all. He's respected by all. Many people don't recognize him as an incarnation. To him, he's a cousin. They love him. They like him. They respect him. But they don't see him as anything necessarily extraordinary. So Krishna tries to mediate the crisis. And he said, all right, if you don't give them their five kingdoms back, give them five villages. Five villages. That's all. One for each. And Duryodhana said, no. I won't give them any land, even the size of a pin. Nothing. Krishna says, all right then. I believe it's war. You're not willing to give on any of this. So the war begins, everybody gains their allies, they're pairing up, and one day Krishna is taking a nap, and Duryodhana comes in and stands at the head of Krishna, and at the very same time Arjuna, who's another Pandu brother, he comes and he's at the feet of Krishna. Krishna is taking a little snooze, and when he opens his eyes up, he sees Arjuna standing there. And then his eyes rise up and he sees that Duryodhana is at his head. Symbolically, Arjuna is the positive forces. He's at humility at Krishna's feet. Duryodhana, in his arrogance, is standing up above his head. He says, what do you want? They have both come to claim him and his armies, Krishna and his armies, as allies. He said, all right, here's the deal. I will join one side, personally, me. But I'm not going to fight. And on my other side is my army, one of the best, one of the finest armies in the entire world. He says, since I opened my eyes and I saw Arjuna first, he gets first choice. Arjuna said, that's easy. I'll take you, Krishna. Duryodhana thought he had won the lottery. Oh, I get the whole army? Really? They'll be loyal to me? Yes, they'll be loyal to you. So Duryodhana gets the army. Arjuna gets Krishna. Arjuna says, Krishna, I want you to be my charioteer. Now, in the battle, the royalty will ride on chariots pulled by horses. The charioteer guides the horses. He's not usually of somebody of nobility, of high rank. They're skilled, but they're a skilled laborer. They're a skilled fighter. So Krishna says, yes, of course, I'll be your charioteer. So the day finally comes. On Duryodhana's side, there's 10 armies. On the Pandu side, there's 7 armies. Now we get into the symbology, because everything has symbolic value in the story. The 10 armies represent the sense mind, the body. There's 5 senses, and as we know, there's the receptors through feeling, I got nerves through sight, I have my eyes, and so I have the 5 different senses, nose, ears, taste, and tongue. In the brain, there's 5 receptors, interpreters of what you're seeing. For instance, you see with your eyes, actually everything gets turned upside down as it comes in. It comes into the brain. There's a part of the brain that interprets the vision. It turns it right side up, and it says, this is distinguished from that. If everything is operating all right, you see color, all the rest of it. That ability equals 2 different kinds of senses, the sense itself and the part of the brain that's able to interpret those impulses that are coming from that sense. That makes 10. That is the body. So Duryodhana has the 10 armies, which represent the 5 senses and the 5 perception of senses. On the other side are the Pandus, and they have 7 armies, and the 7 armies represent the 7 chakras from the base of the spine to the top of the head. And these are the subtle powerhouses that are driven by the life force. They're subtle in that they're more refined than anything of the senses. So you can't see them with a microscope. There's no tools, but you can experience them. And with interior perception, with intuition, you can sense these different places and how they influence the body. Each one of these sub-power stations, so to speak, have specific consciousness that goes with it. So at the base of the spine is the earth and the body and the things that have to do with the body. The second chakra, it has to do with the senses and the sense perception and sense attraction and pleasure and pain all have to do with the second. The third has to do with will and individuality. All 3 of these lower chakras all have to do with the human self. It's not till you get to the 4th chakra that you transcend individuality, just what's personal. You go into the transpersonal, or rather interpersonal. And in the interpersonal, I fall in love with somebody, or I love my mother, or my father, or my brothers, my sister, my children. You awaken something that's outside of you, that's not just strictly concerned with you. So it's interpersonal. It's also transpersonal. If it's divinized love, it lifts you beyond the personal. And now it becomes an impersonal love in that it's not attached to a person, a place, or a thing. It's a state of consciousness itself. And at the 5th center, at the throat area here, then is speech. It is also has to do with truth, discernment of truth, and dharma. Dharma is knowing the correct thing to do. And there's the kind of dharma that you can learn out of the textbook. For instance, in the Bible, Moses goes up and he gets the 10 commandments. That's dharma, the right thing to do and the right things not to do. In the Vedas, it's the yamas and the niyamas, the do's and the don'ts. That interior knowledge where you know what's right to do, that's Yudhisthira. He's the oldest of the Pandus. He's the 5th chakra. Bhima is the 4th chakra. He's incredibly strong. He has to do with the breath. And he represents that 4th chakra in the heart. Arjuna is the 3rd. And Sakadeva and Nakula are the lower chakras. It's interesting that both Sahadeva and Nakula have a different mother than the other 3. Same father, different mother. Physiologically, your spine is separated. You have a lower part of the spine. Your spinal column doesn't actually go completely from bottom to top. there's a separation. And the lower two chakras are in that lower part of the spine, and then the higher chakras are all together with another mother. So it's interesting what these sages knew from ancient times. So the day of the battle finally comes. The armies are matched up against each other, and there is going to be this battle. Arjuna is in his chariot. He has his horses. He has his charioteer, who is Krishna. And suddenly he says, "Krishna, take me out to the middle of the field between these two armies. I want to see these people that I'm going to do battle." Now, he knows who they are. They're all familiar. Many of them are familiar with him, and he with them. So they ride out in between these two vast armies. And he looks across, and he sees his cousins. They've been stinkers all this time, but they're his cousins. Not only that, but there are, because people are tied by treaties and obligations, there are his beloved uncles, teachers, people he knows really well. And he's all geared up for battle. And suddenly he looks across and he sees all of these, and his heart just sinks. All the will to fight goes out of him. He says, "I can't do it. It would be better for me to leave the field, go to a cave and meditate, than be a part of slaughtering these good and these noble people on the other side. I can't do it." What ensues from that then is a conversation between Krishna and Arjuna about many things, but there are many aspects of what it's like to be what we would consider a householder yogi, somebody who lives in the world, participates in the world, doesn't retire to a cave someplace, moves about in the world, has responsibilities in the world. And it's an extreme example, because here's somebody who's going to go to war, a very difficult, tragic thing to do. People are going to die. And Krishna is saying, this is what you're born to do. If you let these people get away who are on the other side with stealing this land, it will not stop there. Because now they will have unbridled power. They will abuse the people who are underneath them. You know, some negativity is going to enter in here that's really going to affect not just this generation, but generations to come. And if you don't stand up for what is right, then this darkness is going to be something that becomes part of the earth, and you're partially responsible. So it speaks to all of us when we're called upon to stand up for what's right. And maybe it's not the popular opinion. Maybe there are bullies involved, and, you know, our health or some part of us is at risk, either to personal ridicule, you know, in society, or we're physically at risk here. And can we stand up for what is right, what is true, especially when it goes against popular opinion, especially when there seem to be people of good and noble virtues on the other side of it? And it's a tough test. I think it's tough for all of us. And so it puts us right, if we are to identify with this, it puts us right into the middle of the field. We're there with Arjuna. Who hasn't had a time that, like Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, "If it be thy will, let this cup pass me by. I don't want to drink of this cup. It's a bitter cup. It's a hard cup to drink from. And if I have my preference, excuse me, I'd like to be excused today." And divine consciousness says, "Nothing doing. You're exactly where you need to be. You need to hang in there. You need to fight the battle. You need to stand up for what is right." And it may not be taking out a sword and cutting somebody's head off, but it may be feeling very risky to you to do what you need to do. It may be standing up and saying a truth, as I say, that it's not popular, that other people may find great difficulty with. And not to do it would allow some injustice or some great evil to precipitate as a result. So we can all identify with that in a social sense, and then we take it to the interior sense. And on the inner sense, we have contending armies within us. We're all a little bit of multiple personality disorders. We've got, gosh, I'd like to go on a diet, but boy, that chocolate cake looks good, you know, and wouldn't I like to have some, well, no, I shouldn't, well, gosh, it looks good, well, I'll do it today and tomorrow I'll start my diet, you know. We have a battle going on right there. It's right, you know, there's Duryodhana and there's Yudhisthira clashing. And who wins? This is not far away, distant stuff for us. It's stuff we all live with. And we all have our battlefield. And it's not the same for everybody. But we all have a place where we have these clashing forces that seem to oppose each other, and we set out with the best of intentions, and yet there's something that undermines our best of intentions. We start out okay, and then we slip off, or we think that it'd be great to start it. How many years have we started off with a New Year's resolution, and, well, the next year rolls around, and the next New Year's, and we're making exactly the same resolution again, and we go, okay, this year, I'm really going to get it. I'm really going to do something about it this year. Another year slips by, and boy, sure enough, the next year we're doing the same thing. So we all have lived with this. We've all gone through these kinds of things. So it hits us where we live. It hits us where we live. And Krishna walks Arjuna through all of his doubts and exhorts him to fight the good fight. So that's on a very kind of personal, psychological kind of basis. Intermixed with all of this, then, is the highest mysticism that weaves in the interior truth of what life is really all about, what we may be able to realize through intuitive apprehension. And during the story, Arjuna has the universal vision unfold for him, where he sees the divine essence in absolutely everything that is. The good, the bad, and the ugly. He sees it all, but he sees that it's all the divine essence. It's one singular power that is behind everything that is. Whatever our perceptions, whatever our senses tell us about it, it obscures this universal vision. We don't see it. We don't perceive it. We get pulled into the world. I like you. You treat me bad. I don't like you. I like this thing, but I don't like this thing. We have attraction and repulsion to everything. That's duality. And our mind gets so melded into that as we think that's who we are. And we don't see anything differently. So Krishna reveals this universal vision to Arjuna, and he is astounded. And he's actually overwhelmed. Now, in the Bible it says no man has ever seen God. And the interior meaning of that is no human consciousness can comprehend the totality of spirit. Because the totality of spirit is too big. It's too vast. You have to leave behind human consciousness in order to comprehend divine consciousness. You can't take it with you. Because human consciousness, by definition, is limited in nature. Divine consciousness, by definition, is expansive and universal in nature. They don't fit. Human consciousness is all right for having a body, interacting with the world, operating as a human being. It's lousy for realizing the divine vision. Can't do it. So you have to leave that behind because you are not that. Even if we believe that we are that because we've lived with it for so long. So you have to transcend that. You have to go beyond that. Arjuna, in a human sense, gets glimpsed this universal vision. But he's not having done the work yet to be able to live in that place. So he comes back down into his own limited consciousness. But he's been given a glimpse, and through his glimpse, we're all given a glimpse. But he can't live with it yet because he has not yet transcended to that state of consciousness. He hasn't earned it yet. So that's kind of the story in a nutshell. And probably the main theme through the teachings of the Gita, and this is on these bullet points, the second bullet point is the Bhagavad Gita, the meaning of it is song of the spirit or the celestial song. When you hear Sanskrit chanted, it's chanted in a song-like manner. It's not real melodious, but it goes up and down. And it's pretty amazing that for perhaps 5,000 years, there have been those people who have memorized this very, very long epic poem. And it's interesting to think that we value reading and writing as such a sign of progress and intelligence. But it's interesting to think that the reason we have reading and writing is because our memory isn't as good as it should be. For people who have memorized these long, long texts and committed that to memory, and that reading and writing is actually kind of a coming down, and oral traditions may have been the superior way. Anyway, so for thousands of years, these were handed down by oral traditions. And it had to be word for word. It couldn't be, how did that go now? You know, it wasn't that. It had to be very specific. And they had these mnemonic learning tools. And one of them was to put it to this almost sing-song kind of way of memorizing. And so it's a song. It's a song of the spirit. And the main theme to the Gita is that one should renounce desires that spring from attachment, which deludes the mind into thinking that it is separate from spirit. Attachment. Now, this predates the Buddha, but the Buddha also speaks a lot about attachment. Attachment is the fundamental problem that deludes the mind and obscures this universal divine vision. And so, when you have attachment, Krishna tells Arjuna, you're grieving for people across the field who are going to die. I can tell you, they're already dead. In fact, we're all already dead. It's just a matter of time. But we're all going to be there. And if that stops you from doing what is right and standing up for what is true, you're deluded. And it's not correct. It's not correct. Through samadhi consciousness, that is a merging of the human individuality into this universal vision, that ignorance of separation is done away with. And so that is the cure. That's the means of getting rid of this delusion, is attaining this interior consciousness where everything is once again unified. It's not just reading about the idea and thinking, I think that that's true. You know, everything's connected. That seems true to me. It's not that. It's having the experience so profound inside of you that every part of your being resonates with the truth of it. There's no place of doubt left inside of you. It's life-changing. And it's not just for a moment that you have a glimpse of that and then you come back down. That's what happened for Arjuna. But that's for the one who has not yet earned that ability to maintain that consciousness. It's something that can be continual. That you can reside in that state of consciousness of recognizing the universality of life as being sacred, as being divine, as being unified? Can you realize it? As my guru, as my teacher used to say, you know and you know that you know. And so that's what is the way to overcome that delusion. And as the song says, we all come from God and into Him we all return. The sage Vyasa is the one who is reputed to have written the Mahabharata. Now, in truth, it seems as if the Mahabharata probably had additions down through time. They got to a point where there's 90,000 verses. And somebody said, enough. It's done. No more. It's complete. It's whole now. No more verses. And as I say, the Bhagavad Gita is a small portion. This is a rendition of the Gita with the Sanskrit and the English that goes along with it. It's not huge. And I have a thinner version than this. It's very small. But it's considered to be the jewel in the crown of the Mahabharata. It's all the wisdom contained in the Mahabharata and actually all of the Vedas all encapsulated into this one teaching. So it's revered throughout India as being kind of the scripture of scriptures. So Sage Vyasa is the reputed author of it. And yet, like all sacred literature, there's this merging between reality and symbology. And you can take people and places and occurrences of things that happen historically. You may weave in some things that are not entirely history in order to tell a greater truth. We get very much into, many people do, is this historically valid? Did this battle actually happen or not? And some people say that it did. But is the story exactly accurate? Did it happen exactly this way? For people who are studying it as a means, as a handbook for realization, it doesn't really matter. That's not the essence of it. As Joseph Campbell said, you don't want to concretize these things. A sacred text should be something that lifts you up and actually takes you beyond the text itself into truth, transpersonal truth. And if you get focused on where did this happen, where is the field of Kurukshetra, where did that actually happen, who are these kings, you know, all of this kind of historical authenticity kind of thing, you're concretizing the symbols. You're not seeing how they can be avenues that you can transcend and go into a higher or more universal consciousness state. So in the creation of these stories, just as even in the creation of the Bible and the New Testament, there can be things that are historically accurate, there can be things that are added. There can be, but with the purpose of telling about and referring to a greater truth. So there's not anything there to get hung up on around the historical aspects of it. And that these prophets or these sages or these saints use everyday events to tell the story. Now, when you read it with that eye and with that in mind, you can begin to see your story, your life. Not just purely concretizing your life, but what does it symbolically represent? Where you were born, the society that you were born into, the parents that you, the friends that you had, the teachers that you had, the enemies that you've had. Suddenly they're not concrete people any longer, but they're symbols of energy, they're symbols of consciousness and how that interacted, what's being told in your story, your Mahabharata. So this is a way to begin to relate in a new way to your own life as well. It's not to get too caught up concretely with everything. In our own guru lineage, there is Babaji and Larhe Mahasya, Sri Yukteswarji, Paramahansa Yogananda. All of them fed into Yogananda's commentary. He drew from them plus his own unique insights. And there's a 2-volume book, God Talks with Arjuna, the Bhagavad Gita, The Royal Science of Realization. And for any of you that are thinking of continuing with this class, then I would recommend that you would get this 2-set volume. And it comes in a softback, which is more affordable as well. So that's something that you can get, and it's profound. It's a profound commentary on these Gita scriptures and tells so much about the interior meanings of these people, places, and events in the teachings. It's really an extraordinary book. And so through this dialogue, Krishna represents intuitive wisdom. If you think of times when you've had your own uplifting experience where suddenly some truth was revealed to you and you realized it, that's Krishna. Krishna's calling. That symbolically is Krishna. Arjuna is the receptive aspirant, the one who's yearning for truth, wanting to know, needing to know the truth, and inquiring about the truth. Arjuna represents that part of us, that's that sincere aspirant who really needs to know. What is the truth here? This is not a philosophy class. This is, I've got to know. And I've got to resolve these doubts that I feel so deeply inside of me. So through Master's commentary, Yogananda's commentary, we come to know that the Pandus, these 5 brothers, represent the 5 chakras, as I talked about earlier, that Duryodhana and his 99 brothers represent qualities of the mind, sense attachments, and the sense mind. Now, why the senses? It's because they're so engrossing. We come into this world, we're born a simple little baby, some doctor whips us up by our feet and slaps us on the back, of course we start crying. It hurts. And suddenly, bang, we're in the body. Oh boy, this is rough stuff. And then we're some little kid, and maybe we have older brothers and sisters, or there's just other kids around, and we're just kind of happy-go-lucky, and suddenly other kids are teasing us, maybe pummeling us and beating us up, and suddenly we're in the battle. We're going, what's this all about? I just showed up here, you know. I was having a pretty good time chasing butterflies, and suddenly I'm told I'm bad and I'm wrong and I'm not this and I'm not that, and why don't I already know that? And I go, yeah, why don't I already know that? Suddenly, I feel ashamed and I feel afraid. And that separation begins to grow. And if it grows enough, I can feel completely isolated in this life. That's the human ego. It isolates us, makes us feel like nobody can understand us, nobody cares, at its most extreme. And at the very least, it just makes us feel separate from other people. And it separates us from this universal vision. So that's we're all born into this battle, whether we like it or not. People say, well, can't it be easier? I mean, isn't there an easy? Well, it's just simply descriptive how we experience things. And it's an extreme example, even as the mystical crucifixion is an extreme example. You go into a Catholic church and you look up and you see the crucifix and you say, oh my God, who wants to sign up for this? I have to be up there, you know? This is rough stuff. But it's telling a story. It's telling a story. And it's telling our story. that all of us have had times where we feel nailed to this cross, which is this body. And it's rough stuff. It's hard. And it explains why it's hard, and it helps to explain how do we get liberation, how do we get free from it. So all great sacred literature does the same thing. It tells the same story, and it's our story. And if we'll take it, it can be our story to attain that liberation. So let me stop there and just see if there's any questions or thoughts about anything said so far. We're all in a battlefield, and we know it. Right. Right. One person's, you know, battlefield can be bulimia, another can be obesity, another can be overly self-conscious, no self-confidence, another can be petrified of getting up in front of groups and speaking. We all have our battlefields. Family situations. And they're the places where these clashing forces, and we all have a battlefield inside of us. We all seem to oppose ourselves. That's not original to you. You know, everybody in this room has had that. So how do you make sense out of it? And that's a kind of a universalizing aspect of the story, is like, this is all of our stories. This isn't just Arjuna's story. This is everybody. And Arjuna's not the only one who's reluctant to enter into it and say, excuse me, can I go off to a nice little quiet cave and just exist there? Do I have to do this? So this is no escapism. It's no escapism. It's saying, this is rough stuff. This is tough stuff. You can do it.
I think it's also when you said, you know, the shame and fear, that reminds me. It's just a good reminder, because it's always there, and you just, it's something that can always bring in more and more and more and more of it, but it's just recognizing that it's just the ego. And so just gently moving beyond that, that's just such a good reminder for me. There's just no end of it. There is no end of fear.
Right.
No end of shame.
That's the value of seeing your life more symbolically, is it allows you to step back and say, okay, everybody experiences this at some time in their life. And so it's not original to me. This is a universal human experience. And by seeing it as a force in my life. Okay, this fear is just simply a force that's coming. It's one of the opposing forces. Now, when I see it that way, in order to see it that way, I have to take a step back in order to have that view of it. This is a force in my life. This is like Arjuna looking across and seeing the armies over there. You're now not totally identified with it. So once we take a step back and we say, gosh, look at these forces operating, some for good, some for bad, but we're now taking a step back towards being the observer, the impersonal observer. We have just taken a step toward freedom. Right there. Right there. And when we take that step back, we have more choice now. When I'm totally identified with it, if it's shame or if it's fear, I've got no freedom. I've got no maneuverability in there. But when I take a step back from it, oh, I can observe this, and now I can breathe. I can let this move through me rather than holding and contracting it in. Wow. That feels better. Now it's moving through me. Sense of tension and pressure begin to release themselves. My whole body begins to relax. And as I stand on the banks of the river and watch this flow by and move by, I'm the impartial observer. It changes my entire perspective of the thing. I relate to it differently now. In a sense, the experience is the same. It can be the same feelings, but my relationship with it has changed. Isn't that great? So that's in the first chapter. Sanjay is the impersonal observer. He's able to watch these things. So, but we won't get too far ahead of our story here. We're right in the introduction right now. Any other thoughts, observations, questions? Means everything's perfectly clear or clear as mud. That Lahari Mahasya and Swami Sri Yukteswar both wrote commentaries. Lahari Mahasya didn't write them, but he taught them, and then some people wrote them down. So Yogananda was able to use some of their insights, as well as his own insights, original insights and understandings, around the interior meanings of the Gita. Does that make sense? Is that different than you were thinking? That clarifies. Okay. Sure. So if you decide to withdraw from the field, actually Krishna addresses that. He says, as long as you breathe and as long as you eat, you're on the field.
You have no choice.
You have no choice. It's just a matter of how you're going to be on the field. And are you going to aspire for and stand up for truth and what is right and dharma, or are you going to try to run? And he says, if you try to run, number one, your own reputation gets ruined, and number two, the world suffers because nobody can take your place. And if you don't do it, it leaves this hole in the world. And that hole will be filled in by opportunists, people who don't behave correctly, people who are not aspiring for something higher. And when that happens, the whole world suffers. So you personally suffer, and the world at large suffers. So the kind of the question comes up, and definitely Krishna's affirmation, Arjuna, you must fight. You must engage in this battle. And we shouldn't get too caught up, well, I don't like war, and you know, it's not that, it's this battle. It's this battle that happens inside of us. The term jihad in the Muslim faith originally meant this interior battle. It wasn't going out to a marketplace and blowing yourself up along with 50 of your best friends. It was this battle, this interior battle. And to wage that battle, it's a spiritual battle. But it's also a battle in the world in the sense of standing up for what is true, for what is right. And sometimes we're a little bit reluctant to do, you know. You get scared. You come on an accident that's happened, and there's people maybe that are hurt, and what do? Call the police? Is there anything you can do? Do you kind of hang back, or do you get in and you do what you can do? I don't want to get my hands bloody. I don't want to see that. But there's people who are suffering. Maybe the help is a long ways away. Maybe somebody is getting pummeled, getting beat up. Do you step in? Do you stand back? What do you do? I remember coming out of meditation service with Mother one time, and there was a man and woman getting out of the car across the street, and they were yelling and arguing loudly. And the man raised his hand to her. And I found myself walking across the street, and I said, "May I help you?" And he turned around, and he saw suddenly all these people were coming out of this building. And they were watching. No, you know, at least he stopped right then. They went inside. I don't know what happened there. Hopefully nothing, but at least, what do you do? What do you do? You know, somebody is lying, and you know that they're lying. Somebody is cheating. Somebody is stealing. And you know that they are. Do you do something? Do you say something? Do you try to stop it? Don't you? Are you afraid of retribution? What might happen? Don't want to get involved? We all face this socially and interiorly. It is. That is a result of it, of entering into the battle. There's a bit of a paradox in there, isn't there? Yeah. Because we don't start out peaceful. We have an interior battle going on. And we have to resolve it. You know, a part of us wants to be peaceful and loving, and somebody cuts us off on traffic and we want to shake our fists at them and honk our horn and what are you doing? And, you know, suddenly we're like this. So we have to work with these oppositional forces. What do we do with that? And, you know, there are some people who talk a lot about peace, but they do it in such a violent way. You go, gosh, does that person know anything about peace on a personal level, interpersonal level? And so, you know, you find that first here. You resolve these battles here. You enter into that war. So Gandhi was, you know, a huge, this is his main scriptures that he studied. And yet here's a proponent of absolute peace, nonviolence. He's raised the Jnani, in the Jains. And no violence, ahimsa. Do no harm. As Hippocrates said, do no harm. And for that you have to have established some center of peace inside of you and love. And Krishna certainly embodies that. He's totally centered. He's never thrown off balance. He does what's right when it's required to do. And he's a friend to all. But But he also stands up for, he sides with Arjuna and the Pandus. He said, no, this isn't right. It can't stand. And he acts. He tells Arjuna, I have nothing to gain from action. I feel complete in myself. And yet I act for the benefit of the world. And then he also represents the universal self, the God consciousness, the entirety. And he said, as that, if I didn't act, all of this creation would disappear like that. So I have to act, or it's all gone. And yet I have nothing to gain from the action. And so the leela, the play, is said to be a joyful expression. And you think, well, look out around the world, it doesn't always look so joyful. And yet, if you go to one of these multiplex cinemas, you see all these different movies playing, and some of them have wars, and some of them are scary, and some of them are beautiful. And so say you're in one of the theaters, and there's this lovely kind of movie unfolding there. And next door, you can hear the bombs going off and the car chases, and you think, you know, I think they'd enjoy this movie over here, you know. Gosh, that sounds awfully violent over there and pretty tough. So you go over there and you go, hey, there's a really nice movie over on the other side. Why don't you come over and watch that? You say, get out of here. I'm watching my movie. I want to see the end of it. No, there's no bombs over there. There's no gunfire. There's no car chases. And if you persist, they'll pick you up and they'll throw you out of the theater. Go back and finish their movie. So, you know, that's entertainment. It's an interesting parallel to how we live our lives and what we regard as what is joyful expression. If we're called into a life to live a hero's life and to attain this, that's a joyful expression. It's intended to be that way. And when we tune in to the original purpose of it, we see it that way, we feel it that way. Everything else is a distortion. It's due to our attachment. Well, that's not the way it's supposed to be. Whoever wrote that script, they've got it wrong. My life isn't supposed to be that. It's supposed to be easier. I'm supposed to have money come easier. I'm supposed to have it more comfortable. I'm not supposed to live like this. Well, who says? You're living like that. I guess that's the way that it's, you know, scripted out. And so when we accept that this is what it's meant for us, then we can see it as a joyful expression. And of course, when everybody is living in attunement with that, the other things will disappear. And Krishna there tries to serve as a mediator, but people have their individual will. They're hell-bent, literally, in this case. Duryodhana is hell-bent. He's unsure of himself. He wants to prove himself. He's jealous of the Pandus. He's everything that our ego, that snarky little ego inside of us can be. He's it. And he's not going to be jollied out of it. And he wants to prove himself. So. Each one of the classes are divided up into three sections. And one will be a discussion because each month we're going to work on a particular aspect of the story. And what that chapter will elicit something. Now, there's lots in every chapter. There's lots of stuff, but we'll take a focal point and work with that for the month and then come back at the end of the month and can have some discussion about what that was. How did that go? How did it go for that month? And then an introduction for the next section and then assignment off into the next month. So for this coming month, for all of you who would like to participate, is the page with the picture. And that's Krishna standing and Arjuna is down on his knee. He's thrown down his bow and his arrows and he says, I don't want to do this. So the Mahabharata, including the Bhagavad Gita, is the story of every human being describing their descent into ego or separated from his or her divine consciousness and the gradual ascent into the divine omniscience. The characters of the story represent aspects of the individual. The battle described in the Gita is the war of opposites that exists within each of us. Thinking of your life as an allegory for spiritual growth, look for those places, people, and events that signal an aspect of your story. For instance, a move to a new place can represent either an ascent or descent in consciousness. Meeting someone can represent becoming open to a new aspect of yourself. And getting a new job, the death of someone close, or some trauma can represent a new stage in your life. Reflect on your life's events as an allegory for your journey, especially your psychological and spiritual journey. This may be a new way of thinking of your life and may take some adjustment. Joseph Campbell once told his class that it may be easier to think of the Ganges as a sacred river than the Ohio River as being sacred. Attune your thoughts to the symbolic value you can now associate with them in your life. You may like to write a narrative of your life as a symbolic journey to this point. So many of us look at our lives and concretize the symbols, the people, the places, the events in our life that happen, and we feel stuck with them. It's like a dead end. And if we see them as something symbolic, so somebody who acts as an oppositional force to you, a mother, a father, a brother, a sister, who just seems to be always goading you, always going after you, always a difficulty, you can personalize it and say, look at what this person did. Or you can say, there's Duryodhana. You know, he's that stinker of a cousin. And he's always in there. He's unsure of himself. He's always testing himself. He's always wanting to get things going, get things stirred up. And now you don't see it so much as a personal thing, but as a psychic or spiritual force in your life. And something that is there to awaken the divinity within you. When you come up against a hard struggle, and you have to dig deeper in yourself in order to overcome. You grow as an individual. You grow in spiritual strength and power and self-worth if it acts as a positive sense. If it tears you down, if it takes you down and you destroys your self-worth, that becomes a battle that you lose that battle. But you haven't lost the war. So you begin to look at your life in this way. And so, as an example, I just thought, and you can make it fun. You can have some fun with this too. So life is a parable. I was born in the region of the Sun Dynasty area, named Sunnyside. It's the town where I grew up. So that's the Sun Dynasty. Of a father working in the Vaishya caste, agriculturalists and traders. A tradition that had come from many ancestral generations before. Sunnyside was originally conceived as a religious community, blessed by the Ash of Agni, the god of fire, from Mount Tahoma, which means the mother of waters, a.k.a. Mount Rainier. The area was blessed with rich soil and later became an agricultural center. I was the third son of three children. The eldest son continued the family business. I had a calling for another destiny. Parallel to the coast of the Pacific, meaning the peaceful ocean, runs a spine of mountains, the Cascades. San Diego, a place of zoo of animal nature, forms the base chakra along this spine. Los Angeles is the second chakra, the place of sensuality and love of pleasure and the film industry. Sacramento, the secular home of state government, is the third chakra of individual will. San Francisco, where the heart was left, as the song goes, is the fourth. Portland, a portal of wind up the Columbia River Basin, is the fifth, the windpipe and place of speech. Seattle, a place of vision, is the sixth, and Vancouver, Lotus Land, is the seventh. I was called to Seattle, where I met my guru. This move over the mountains represented a radical new phase of my life as I left behind the family traditions of land-based living to seek a new vision of reality. As a truck driver, I traveled up and down the corridor of the Cascadian spine along I-5. This cascade or waterfall of energy of going up and down this corridor while chanting the name of God was tantamount to a kriya breath. As a sadhaka, a spiritual aspirant, forces gathered about me, both positive and negative. My guru, Mother Hamilton, came as Krishna, a guiding light while I was yet in a darkened state. Dhrishtarashtra was dominant in my life, guided as I was by the sense mind. Yet the Ganga, or Kutastha Chaitanya, or Christ consciousness, was awakening itself within, beyond my own ability to understand. Pandu, or pure discriminating intelligence, the son of Ambalika, these names are all defined in this book here. So some of them may seem very foreign to you, but if you read this introduction and first chapter, it'll explain a lot about these names. This body, or the Kurukshetra, or field of action, witnessed the back and forth, up and down battles of the positive and negative forces, the Pandus and the Kurus. Arjuna, my will aligned with divine will, was sometimes strong and clear, and at other times my Arjuna wanted to retreat from the field of battle and let the Kurus have their way. The entry of Draupadi, the Kundalini force and wife of the Pandus, accelerated this battle. The Kurus forced the Pandus into the jungle in hiding and tried to disrobe Draupadi, both shaming her with a desire to dissipate her with lust, anger, and dominance. Draupadi appealed to Krishna, and she was saved from being disgraced in this way. Lust comes to dominate the sadhaka, but when the intention and prayers go to God, the attempt to reduce Draupadi, or Kundalini, to nothing, and tries to destroy the Pandus by the downward forces, they do not succeed. Thus, complete and total reliance upon God is engendered. The pure vibrational forces of the Pandu brothers, the first to the fifth chakras, are awakened. Draupadi is keen to see the destruction of the Kurus and aligns herself through love to all the five Pandus, the five chakras. The Pandus then align themselves with Krishna, the Ajna at the point between the eyebrows. Ultimately, in the battle between the noble Bhishma, the universal ego, the expanded self that has but a thin veil between itself and absolute universal consciousness, must give its life voluntarily. Bhishma dies on a bed of arrows in the form of a cross. As the Gita unfolds, Krishna grants a vision to Arjuna that none else can see. During this revelation, Arjuna has a glimpse of the universal vision, not usually experienced by the lower chakras. No man has ever seen God. But it comes so that the human nature can be inspired by the truth and profundity of this vision. This vision does not permanently establish the self in divine consciousness, so Arjuna must still carry out his duty and defeat the Kurus, the negative forces. There can be a false sense of mastery when this vision is granted, so the ego self must be eradicated to going all the way to the full and complete mastery attained through the winning of the war. All of these states I've described, I've experienced. The struggle can be long and arduous, but there is no getting around this. Only those who have been through this battle may transcend ego consciousness and be established in divine consciousness. The Gita is a handbook intended to point the way to the five lower chakras representing the Son of Man. Only those who take the attitude of the Pandus may ascend this ladder of consciousness in the spine and brain. Only those who know the spirit of Sahadev, Nakula, Arjuna, Bhima, and Yudhisthira, and is granted the guidance of Krishna, may come into the kingdom of heaven, a heaven that is right within you. And so you can take people, events in your own life, begin to think of them as part of your symbolic journey, your spiritual journey. Those people who have helped you in your ascension, those people who have tested you and tried to defeat you, tried to beat you down, tried to eradicate any sense of light or the divine within you. This is the battle that's going on the outside and on the inside. And so it's interesting to look at your life from a symbolic standpoint. And now these symbols, and as we talked about earlier, when you take a step back and see these people, places, and events as symbols rather than concrete things or people, you have now dissociated yourself to some extent from them, and you have more maneuvering room. You feel more free from them. Now, if you have an abusive father or mother or brother or sister, step back and you go, well, it's not about them as a person. That was a challenge that came into my life. That was a spiritual force. That was an opposing force that came in. And how did I do? What did that call upon me? Did I draw into my life positive forces in order to help combat that then? If not that then maybe later. I begin to see this, and they're like pawns on the chessboard rather than something that's close and personal to me. That gives me a new perspective on them. They're now impersonal spiritual forces versus people who have it out to get me, which may or may not have been the case. So is there any thoughts, comments, questions about... Yeah. Right.
So somebody has to lose something in there.
Yeah.
He'll lose his love for his uncle, or he's never to hate him.
Well, and that's part of Krishna's teaching. Don't enter into this with hate. Enter into it with discrimination. This is something that must be done. So symbolically, you have somebody who was a wonderful influence on you earlier in your life, and they taught you things, and you really valued them. But at some point, there was some things, maybe they didn't have any kind of spiritual notion about them at all. In fact, they kind of poo-pooed that whole idea around spirituality. In order for you to ascend up in spiritual consciousness, you have to leave them behind. You can take the good that they gave you, but there's part of the package you have to leave behind. Otherwise, you're going to feel embarrassed. Otherwise, you're going to feel self-conscious. Otherwise, you're going to not allow yourself to transcend that. Let's say somebody grows up in kind of a blue-collar kind of a household. And the boss is the man, you know, and he's kind of the enemy. I had a union worker once tell me, that man's your enemy. And so you grow up with that kind of belief system, but inside of you, you'd like to become the boss. So Freud said, a wise man defeats his father. You have to transcend kind of what was handed to you if you're going to become the owner of the company. Otherwise, you're the man. And you're not going to allow yourself to make that transition. And if you're called upon to be the owner of the company, then you're going to have to transcend that. You're going to have to cut the head off of your father, say. It's a graphic kind of way of talking about it, but you have to go beyond the things that were handed to you when you were growing up, even though they may have been very useful to you at the time. Because they're limiting, of a limiting nature. So you can appreciate and value what you're given in a good way, but you have to transcend them. You have to go beyond them. I grew up with a father who was very concrete. You know, it's what's on the ground here. It's business. And what makes... Very ethical person, but very... It's all about making sense and making it in a material sense completely... horizontal plane, nothing vertical about him, other than his adherence to doing the right thing. He had a strong sense of Dharma in that way. And he didn't understand me or my life at all. Had no way to relate to it. If I had at any point said, I kind of don't want to go against my father or a lot of the people that I know. So I'm not going to go into the spiritual because it doesn't fit with their worldview. It would embarrass me. Maybe they would think badly about me. And I allow that to limit me for what I'm really called for. I'm in trouble because I'm not responding to something that I'm really being called to. Because it doesn't fit with a paradigm that other people have for me. But, yes, but there may come a time where there's a conflict, there's a clash. Mm-hmm. What are you doing all this stuff for? So as my father, when I went to take Kriya initiation, And I was working for him at the time, and it's seasonal work. And when you work all the time. Don't forget about taking time off. That doesn't exist during season. So it happened in June, which is in asparagus season. So I said, well, I need a week off. And I was ready to quit if that didn't happen. Well, this is unheard of to ask for time off. What do you want that for? So I laid it out there, and I said, this is really important to me. And he may have gotten the sense that I was willing to walk if I did. And to his, he had no understanding of what this is about, but he let me go for the week. But if I allowed myself to be corralled in by other people's attitudes and thoughts and possible judgments, they can be good people, but I'm not being myself. And it kills me spiritually. It kills me on a soul level. I can't do it. And so they've come into my life as an oppositional force. They're not intending to. They're just being themselves. But in essence, that's what that's being acted out. Those can be tough places. And people can get their feelings hurt. They can never talk to you again. They can, you know, things can happen that way. And they're real challenges for us. You know, we can be afraid. I remember when the first apartment that I had, it was what do they call it when it's all one, you know, kitchen and... Yeah, bachelor apartment. So everything, I mean, you walk into the front door, you see everything, right? So I have my meditation blanket, and I put up some pictures, and And I'm a little self-conscious about it. It was the first time I thought, well, you know, my parents and family, and you know, they'd probably never come and see me. In the first week, my parents came, my brother and sister and nephews came, and my grandmother came, everybody came. You know, after that, it's like, who cares, you know? It's all out there. But it's these battles that we get into. I don't want them to know, or, you know, do I try to pull in and be a little bit less of myself? And particularly when I feel a calling for something. I remember there's a young East Indian student and some friends in India. They said, will you go? And he's coming to the University of Washington. He's an engineering student. So we had some very nice times together, and I would take him out. And he said both of his parents were doctors. I said, oh, and you're an engineering student? He said, yeah. I said, was there some pressure there to be a doctor? He said, you know what? There really wasn't. They just wanted me to succeed at what I wanted. But you can imagine, you know, if you have this whole tradition, you know, my mother and father, my mother particularly, wanted me to be a part of the family business. And when I wasn't, that was a huge disappointment. Not much was said, but I felt it. I felt it. So these are the places where we live. So does that kind of make sense then? And you begin to see these forces as impersonal spiritual forces rather than just the people. If you just see it as the person and, oh, I have a difficult time with this person, you've concretized the symbol and you're less likely to transcend them. You get stuck with them. They're like a closed door that you keep bumping up against. But once you see it as an impersonal psychological spiritual force, suddenly, oh, that's come into my life. I can transcend that. Go beyond it. It helps free you. So what I'd encourage you to do is take some time with it and start to write some of this out. Your life as an allegory. Your life as a symbolic story. Where you were born. Forces that came in to help you, lift you up. Other forces that came that definitely acted as oppositional forces. Could have been loving. Could have been a mother who kind of smothered you and wanted, you know, come on, come on, come on. But you felt, oh, I've got to break free of this. So I won't be here for every one of the classes. I don't know. There's 18 chapters. So once a month we'll do a chapter, and if I'm not here, then there'll be a recording for kind of the previous month, and then there'll be some group discussion, and then a portion of it for what's coming up for the next month. And it's just there's a beautiful structure to the Gita, where it just takes you kind of step by step through the spiritual journey. So by the end of the 18 months, or 18, yeah, 18 months, then you'll all be realized. If you follow it. If you come a little short, then it may take, you know, a little longer. So thank you for coming. Pronouns, I bow to the light within you. So I encourage you to get Master's commentary on the Gita, and don't. Just a note of encouragement. It's Yogananda really packs in the information. And the information is also goes along with the Gita itself. The Gita is in dark print. If you start to feel like it's overload, like it's too much, what he's giving in the commentary, my encouragement is don't get bogged down with that. Just read the Gita itself once through in a chapter. It reads beautifully by itself. And then take what's useful from the commentary. But you can literally, you can spend the rest of your life studying the commentary. There's a lot there. And I just don't want you to kind of go, gosh, this is a lot, and there's lots of names here, and I don't know what they mean, and I'm kind of getting foggy-brained here. The idea is not to get foggy-brained, it's to get inspired. So if it's a little bit of foggy-brained, just let that portion go. Just read the Gita the Gita itself through, and then take from the commentary what's useful. And then you can always go back and get more.